Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Tomorrow, Florida lawmakers will gather in Tallahassee for the beginning of their 2018 session, but this annual law writing session begins against a backdrop of sexual harassment and sexual misconduct scandals, tight state finances despite a booming economy, and an approaching and expensive election this autumn. On today's program, we will talk about the $80-plus billion spending plan lawmakers will debate in the coming weeks, including the two biggest slices of state spending, education and health care. But before we tackle the budget, we spoke about the climate in the state legislature as two senators have resigned over sex scandals leading up to session. One, Democrat Jeff Clemons, quit after an extramarital affair he was having with a female lobbyist became public. The second, Republican Senator Jack Latvella, resigned under growing pressure after a Senate investigation into sexual harassment claims against him was referred to a criminal probe. That's the environment for lawmakers as they reconvene in Tallahassee tomorrow with one constitutionally required job, pass a state budget. We sat down with Democrat Jared Moskowitz from Western Broward County, the ranking member of the Florida House Appropriations Committee, and Republican Carlos Trujillo from Western Dade County, the chairman of the Appropriations Group.
It's been the elephant in the room for many, many years. I'm proud to say, as a member of the Florida House, that none of those accusations have been levied against any of our members. It seems to be focused strictly on the Senate, but it's something that needs to be addressed. And I think the entire culture in Tallahassee, when it comes to sexual harassment, needs to change. And I'm glad we're having the conversation.
How does it change the environment as you have this concentrated eight-week period to get one thing done, and that is to pass a budget?
I think it puts a lot of pressure on the Senate. In the House, we're not dealing with those realities. In the Senate, there's been a lot of accusations. There's multiple members that have resigned. I think, you know,
two. There have been two that have resigned.
Two that have resigned in the last 2 months.
Right.
Two of the most powerful members in the Senate.
One Democrat, one Republican.
Yeah, the Appropriations Chairman and the up-and-coming Minority Leader. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be surprised if those are the last two to resign because of these allegations. So I think it's really an issue that the Senate's going to have to deal with. There's a lot of trust issues amongst the members. And going forward, it's going to be very difficult to pass their agenda, seeing the instability within their membership.
Representative Moskowitz, do you see it the same? How's the atmosphere looking to you?
I mean, it's a little more of the same, but for different reasons. I think last year the Senate was disorganized. I think they were fighting amongst themselves. They kind of got their stuff together towards the end. But ultimately, I think the whole atmosphere, not just within the Senate, but all of Tallahassee right now, is kind of on edge. You saw that really the last couple weeks of committee week. I mean, I was never one that stayed out late anyways, but just walking back from the Capitol to where I'm staying, people weren't in the restaurants, right? They weren't at the governor's club. If you were having dinner with somebody, people wanted to know why. I think everybody is reassessing, themselves and their priorities in this new atmosphere. But there's no doubt for what the chairman said is true. And I don't know that this is necessarily over yet in the Senate either.
Is it, do you think it won't touch the House?
Well, look, there's 120 members. I don't pretend to know the private lives of 119 other members. But what we can say is that this has now been out in the open now for 3 months, and not one name in the House has been put forward.
You feel that way too, Chairman?
Absolutely, and I think it's important, the members. In the House, I know the House leadership very, very well. I know them personally. I can't imagine even accusations being levied against any of those members on the Democratic side or the Republican side. In the Senate, I don't think you could say the same.
This edge that you talk about, Representative Moskowitz, is it entirely attributable to the sexual harassment and the sexual comments that have now been made public and have cost Senator Jack Latvella his Senate seat? He's resigned under investigation, as well as Senator Jeff Clemons, who resigned after admitting to an extramarital affair.
Well, politics, for all of the talk about it being partisan, is also personal. And there were already personality conflicts in the Senate that were well on display last year. Those divisions now have grown dramatically. And, you know, the real question now over the next 8 weeks is Senator Latvella sitting on $4 million of money that he raised. Is there going to be retribution for those people who came after him in the Senate? That's unclear. Whether it even happens in the next 8 weeks or happens during the election cycle, those are the things that are going to permeate above the surface during session. On every bill, on every issue, on every vote, this is what is going to be in the back of people's minds. Had he stayed, I think it would have been worse. But this is a wound, and all we've done now is just kind of rip the scab off, I think.
This edge that you describe leading up to the opening of the 2018 session, how is that going to influence lawmaking, particularly as it relates, again, to that one constitutional job that the two chambers have to do, which is to agree on how to spend billions and billions of taxpayer money?
Well, it's probably going to be the most interesting year, at least since I got up to Tallahassee in 2012. Not only do you have the issues of the last several months, but you have a governor potentially running for higher office. You have a speaker potentially running for higher office. You have members in the House running for higher office. And so that in itself also will factor into priorities, positioning, that with the atmosphere is probably going to make the most interesting 8 weeks we've seen in a long time.
Chairman Trujillo, how about that edge? How does it influence policymaking, especially financial policymaking? Does it give the House and your committee, specifically the House Appropriations Committee, even more leverage, even more influence in the budgetary process?
It does, and we've experienced one thing that the House is when we make a promise, we could keep it. We have the discipline within our membership. We communicate well with each other. We have the ability to deliver. The Senate, unfortunately, doesn't have that same discipline. Losing two members doesn't help. The lack of trust amongst the membership, I'm sure, is not helping the situation. And going forward, I think I don't think that'll be settled. I think that's only going to be excavated.
Chairman Trujillo, you mentioned losing two senators who have resigned. There's at least another House member who resigned. Those seats will remain open during the session. You are awaiting Senate confirmation for the ambassadorial position of the Organization of American States, the OAS. That vote could happen at any moment during session. What would that mean for the constituents of your district who voted you in to represent them during this 8-week session?
Well, my goal is to represent them as long as I can. We've already worked on drafting the budget. We should have it rolled out by the 4th or 5th week of session. It's getting into its final phases, so I think my constituency will be very well represented, and I think the budget will ultimately be passed.
Will you be able to make it to the end of the session in March? Do you know?
I do not know, but my goal is to make it as to the end of the session.
So you anticipate, even if you are confirmed, you would still be able to serve out at least this legislative session?
I believe so. Obviously, I'm not in charge of that timeline, but my goal is to serve as long as I can.
Republican Carlos Trujillo, as he awaits action by the U.S. Senate on his nomination to be American ambassador to the Organization of American States, he chairs the House Appropriations Committee in Tallahassee tackling the state budget. So, still to come, how the state tax money is measuring up for lawmakers.
Right now, we are dealing with at least several hundred million to $1 billion deficit.
It's not about how much money you spend. I think we get lost in it. It's what you spend it on.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. November was a pretty good month for the state of Florida. The state brought in $122 million more in taxes and fees than it anticipated. But September and October were weaker than expected months. Of course, those were the months, especially September, much of the state was dealing with Hurricane Irma, which also likely hurt tourism, a huge contributor to state revenue through sales taxes. In mid-September, less than a week after Irma made landfall in the Lower Keys, Florida's chief state economist, Amy Baker, warned lawmakers the state's finances were tight even before the storm came ashore.
The bottom line is that you are, even before we start talking about Irma, you were looking at a need to begin addressing the structural imbalance that we were seeing as quickly as you can.
That structural imbalance she refers to is the widening gap between money the state collects through taxes and fees and the money it spends, most of it on healthcare and education. The long-range financial forecast for the state forecasts a $1 billion shortfall in 18 months and another $1.5 billion by fiscal year 2020, assuming all things remain equal. Of course, they won't. But first, lawmakers have to deal with the next fiscal budget beginning in July. We spoke with Democrat Jared Moskowitz from Western Broward County, the ranking member on the Florida House Appropriations Committee, and Republican Carlos Trujillo from Western Dade County, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. And we began with his forecast for red ink as lawmakers begin the legislative session this week.
I would anticipate in the $700 to $800 million, probably even approaching $1 billion, but there's still a lot of unknowns. The hurricane cleanup, we still don't have a final number. The sales tax estimations, if they're off 3% or 4% or 5%, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think week three or week four of session, we'll have a much better idea. But right now, we are dealing with at least several hundred million to $1 billion deficit.
Meantime, Governor Scott's budget proposal is $4 billion more in spending than it is this current fiscal year.
I believe so,
so that's
yes.
A $5 billion difference, perhaps, in what reality is in terms of the revenues of you're expecting and what the governor would like to spend.
Yeah, and I think the governor's budget, remember, it came out prior to the last revenue estimate conference, which did change the landscape extensively. It also has a much faster reimbursement rate from the federal government. Hopefully he's successful in securing that so that the $4 million, even though it seems like such a large number, those two factors really change that number from four, probably closer to 1.5 or 2.
Representative Moskowitz, how do you see the financial condition of the state of Florida as lawmakers reconvene in Tallahassee?
I mean, I see it really no different than just 2 or 3 years ago when we did not have $1 billion of new money coming into the system every year, right? So I think for the last 2 years, we were very fortunate to see huge amounts of revenue coming in that we could reinvest into the state. So we're going to have to, again, similar conversation from last year. It's not about how much money you spend. I think we get lost in it. It's what you spend it on. And so this is really just a priority conversation. We could spend $78 billion. We could spend $83 billion. It's just, what do we decide to spend it on? Mm-hmm. And so, look, the speaker has talked about potentially because of the cost with hurricane, the hurricane-related expenses, Hurricane Irma, that we're going to see maybe less member projects and more investment into some of the things that need to be paid for and obviously some potential mitigation. We've been fortunate in Florida for the last decade not to have a hurricane of this magnitude. But that luck ran out this year, and it's unclear if now we're in some sort of pattern where we've seen in the past where we might have real hurricanes for a period of time. So I think some pre-planning, putting some more money in reserves might even be something to discuss.
Reserves are already at $1 billion. You think maybe putting even more money aside?
Well, here's why I think that it should at least be looked at. Hurricane Irma hit. Hurricane Irma was devastating to Collier County. It was devastating to Monroe County. It was devastating to Lee County. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the state dealt with really just a vegetative debris cleanup. Had Hurricane Maria just taken a slightly different path and had it come in and it impacted Brevard County or Volusia County or Palm Beach County, you're talking devastation in a much more populous area on a massive scale. And so what I'm saying is that we need to start thinking about potentially two hurricanes in the same season, okay? Hurricane Irma, because it was a vegetative cleanup among the whole state and not more of a construction damage, more homes outside of the two counties, I think we have to have more money in reserve potentially for dealing with that. Additionally, if you listen to the head of FEMA, based on this being unfortunately probably one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive year for FEMA on record between Irma and Harvey and Maria and the fires in California. States are going to be, I think, a little more on their own and have to be a little bit less dependent on the federal government potentially for reimbursement.
Chairman Trujillo, hurricanes have been a fact of life for all the state legislative sessions. Does Hurricane Irma change the finances of what the Appropriations Committee in the House is willing to make those priorities and spend the money on?
Yeah, I think it changes the finances, changes the priorities. We have $3.5 billion in reserves. The Senate's already come out saying, well, we should raid the reserves in order to pay for the hurricanes. On an $84-85 billion budget that will probably pass this year, $3 billion really is not that much money. I agree that we should try to add an additional billion, get that number up to four. pay our expenses and start building that up as high as we possibly can. And the reality is, what are our priorities? What are we spending the money on? So if we're taking money from reserves, what are we spending that money on? Is it really to pay for hurricane cleanup, or is it to pay for a bunch of member pet projects that at the end of the day really don't affect Floridians' lives?
The state economist Amy Baker has said often to the budgetary committees, you've heard her testify to the strategy of taking money out of reserves or taking money out of trust funds, which is also a very common technique of your colleagues, is a one-time affair. It's a little bit like taking money out of your savings account. You can do it once, but unless you're putting more money into that savings account, you can't go back to it in year two and year three.
And the reality is that there's no need. If we were in a true economic recession, as we were in 2009 and 2010 and 2008, you would really have to make those tough, tough decisions. But we're not. Revenue estimates are off. They're off 3, 4, 5%. They're not off 15. We have the money in the reserves. We could easily cut a lot of member projects, which, you know, it's unfortunate you can't come home with your new playground or swimming pool or YMCA, but the reality is it won't affect Floridians. And we have a responsibility to make sure that the future, at least the next legislative session, doesn't start off with a huge deficit.
The same person here, the state economist Amy Baker, has said Florida has a structural imbalance. You referred to this, Chairman Trujillo, is spending just outpacing revenues. How do you begin to address it? Is this the year that the legislature is going to successfully address that?
It has to be. You have to curtail member appetite. And unfortunately...
Is that the only place where you see the ability to shave dollars out of the budget?
Well, we analyzed last year, so there's recurring and non-recurring revenue.
Right.
Some of it we can't touch. It's federal trust funds, Medicaid matching. But the money we can't touch, the recurring member projects and non-recurring member projects. For the last 2 years, it's the first time that members had to own their projects. They actually had to put their name next to their projects before they filed them. Right. We didn't allow any recurring projects because it's not fair that my priority, even though I'm leaving the Florida House, has to be the next legislative priority and in all perpetuity. So those are some small changes we've made. But at the end of the day, we have to hold our membership accountable.
What Chairman Trujillo is identifying there is member projects can really make the difference. Do you see it the same way? Is it member projects that can really make the difference in terms of addressing the structural imbalances that the state economist has identified in the state spending plan, Representative Moskowitz?
Well, I agree that it's member projects, but I think what he's also talking about is member appetite, meaning that spending money in all different areas, just beyond bringing home that one project.
It's more than just the community pool.
It's just, right, there are other areas that we decide to put all sorts of money in. What I do agree with is that, you know, member projects is something that came down last year because of the accountability in the House. The Senate did not pick up the same accountability, although they adopted a little bit of the House process. Is that will have to come down again. But I'll say the same thing I've said previously. I don't think all member projects are created equal just because they have a member in name on it, right? So a fountain might not be the same as an African-American museum. Or funding for the homeless might not be the same as a building that is not necessary. So I think by having members put their names on it and them actually going to a committee and talking about their bill and there being a process in the House, that transparency vets the whole process. And so when that member brings that issue forward, it's not just the member, then the members of that committee have to sign on to putting that forward. So it becomes more of a collective unit.
Chairman Trujillo, member projects can account for several hundred million dollars. And we've seen Governor Scott in his tenure line item veto $400 million worth of member projects, $500 million dollars worth of member projects. Is it addressing the long-term structural imbalances that the state economist is discussing here? And that is the continued growth of spending. And we'll talk specifically about where that goes, the majority of it going to education and to healthcare. But when you're talking about state dollars, it's really dominated by education. But the state spending trajectories continuing to increase while the state trends for revenue increases have begun to plateau.
But the lack of discipline is in recurring member projects. So a classic example is I love, you know, my local university. So I'm going to show up with this new building, and that building costs $50 million. So I'm going to ask for $5 million this year. The next year, I'm going to ask for another five, and then we're on the hook because we're already 20% of the way there. We're on the hook for the other $40 million in the back end for that building, and that's the classic example. If we don't allocate money for a new building in any university system, we have 5 years worth of backlog before they're all completed. But I'm sure this year, every single member, or the majority of the members, are going to come saying, we need a new X, Y, or Z center at my favorite university. Could you give me $2 or $3 or $5 million to start the construction? And that's when the economist comes in and says, well, you guys have a spending problem. You allocate all these future obligations, and then future legislatures have to pay for them.
Is there a building revenue challenge, though, as well, after the state is beginning to realize the several years worth of tax cuts that Governor Scott and Republicans have been able to approve over the course of many, many years? You're talking about most recently tax cuts on commercial rents, tax cuts on cell phone services and cable services. It may not seem like a lot per household, and it's not, but to the budget, it can be $100 million less in revenue.
It can be, but we could also allocate $1 billion to a dike without having federal coordination that cost taxpayers $1 billion.
So you shook your head when I said, are you realizing a revenue challenge here from tax cuts, previous legislation?
I think there's nobody in Tallahassee, no economist will say the biggest issue we face here is that we have a lack of revenues. We're the third most populated state. We have tourism at an all-time high. We depend strictly on sales tax. The economy is absolutely roaring. Property values are through the roof. Everything is doing exceptionally well from every economic indicator. The biggest problem that we have is that we eat more than we exercise.
Representative Moskowitz, you see the appetite the same way?
Well, I agree on this front, right? I mean, you wouldn't run your personal finances the way that the state spends money, right? You don't spend all the money that comes in. You put some away, right? And you put it away for a rainy day. You put it for a bad year or two bad years. I mean, that's what folks around the kitchen table are making those decisions every day. When politicians go to Tallahassee or any other state capital or Washington, D.C., for that matter, they're spending other people's money, which is much easier. I disagree with him slightly on tax cuts in this respect. I think because Florida is so dependent on property values that when we start chipping away at other areas of revenue, we're not anticipating for what we do again if there's another property downturn. And we saw what happened, right? When the property values tanked, what did the legislature have to do? They raised fees in order to make up that difference. The state of Florida is going to have a very unique opportunity, I think, over the next couple of years, because with the new federal tax cuts that have now been passed, wherever you stood on them, good, bad, or indifferent, they're now the law of the land. You're going to see other states like New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, I think, starting bleeding people and businesses to the state of Florida. We have to be ready to create an environment for those people to come, and I don't think tax cuts on the communications cell phone bill is what would have done that. I think there are other areas that we could be doing tax cuts.
That's Florida House Appropriations Committee ranking Democrat Jared Moskowitz from Coral Springs. Still to come, as our conversation continues, one of the largest areas for state tax dollars.
I think there's always an appetite to spend money on education. But I think at least my number one question are, what are the outcomes?
We should have an outcome-based system. We shouldn't just throw money at something without understanding the outcome. What I would add to that, though, is that we now have a multi-tiered education system in the state of Florida.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy, Sex, Spending, and the Legislative Session. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Just 7 months ago, Florida lawmakers, Republicans really, were at odds over billions of dollars in state spending. Republican Governor Rick Scott had vetoed a big slice of education funding. He wanted more money than lawmakers approved. It was one of the issues that led to a special 3-day session for lawmakers to boost per-student spending by $100, enough to secure Governor Scott's signature. So this year, the state is spending almost $7,300 per student, and Governor Scott wants to bump that up by $200 per student next year. We spoke with Democrat Jared Moskowitz from Western Broward County, the ranking member on the Florida House Appropriations Committee, and Republican Carlos Trujillo from Western Dade County. He's the chair of the Appropriations Committee.
Just deciding we're going to spend $200 this year as opposed to $50 last year as opposed to maybe $75 next year. What's the outcome difference? Does that move the needle? Are children getting a better education? Are they reading better? Are they writing better? Have their mathematical and analytical skills improved? If that's not the answer, then why are we just putting money there?
The state would be required to spend $200 million more in 2018, 2019 on education, K through 12 education, if we're to maintain the current per pupil spend, simply because of population growth, domestic influx of folks escaping maybe high tax states like Representative Moskowitz mentioned earlier in New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts, but a large number of Puerto Ricans, of course, coming to Florida because of the devastation in Hurricane Maria. Is there an appetite to be able to supply the new dollars that are necessary in order to keep education spending in the next fiscal year, Chairman Trujillo, even?
You know, I think there's always an appetite to spend money on education. But I think at least my number one question are, what are the outcomes? And if we spend $200 million or $300 million or $1 billion, are those outcomes any differently? The FEF piece per student. So the number goes up. It goes up in the aggregate, $200 million.
That's the formula that the public schools get.
The number per student stays the same. Right. So obviously we take that into any of our projections. We take into account the additional students. So what the governor is proposing is, not only do we take into account the additional, let's say, 100,000 students that have come over from Puerto Rico and just natural growth of Florida, but on top of that, we're going to take those into the budget. We're also going to give every other student who's in the system and the new ones an additional $200 per student.
You don't think that's money wisely spent?
No, I think money in education is always wisely spent, but across the board, just throwing money at the entire institution and saying, because we put in $200, we're going to have a better outcome at the end, I don't think it's the best use of resources. If we're putting it into specific programs, if we're putting it into specific students, if we're putting it into specific systems, I think that's the best way to spend money. So if we realize that there's a shortcoming, and if that shortcoming is inner city minority schools, why not spend that entire money, the entire $200 million, saying we're addressing this problem only in this population, because this is a population that has the biggest learning losses or the biggest learning gaps.
Some would say that the legislature did that with the Schools of Hope legislation in terms of directing new dollars into those urban schools. But I want to get Representative Moskowitz in here on the approach that Chairman Trujillo is talking about in terms of, first of all, the overall spending increase that would be required in order to keep the per pupil spending even in the next year. Is that something that the legislature has appetite for? And secondly, the governor's own a budget proposal, which is to increase that by $200 per student.
Yeah, I can't speak for the governor. I would have to imagine that the governor does not want to see a decrease in the per pupil spending. So he's going to want to at least keep with the pace,
which is going to cost roughly $200 million.
I would be surprised if we see a decrease. Where I agree with the chairman is that we should have an outcome-based system. We shouldn't just throw money at something without understanding the outcome. What I would add to that, though, is that we now have a multi-tiered education system in the state of Florida, right? Whether you agreed with it, disagreed with it, it's here.
Meaning
public schools,
charter schools,
private schools, chartered schools,
parochial,
and most of them are getting some sort of state money now. And so if we want to have an outcome-based system and we want to hold public schools accountable, which I think we should do, everyone has to be on the same playing field then. We have to hold all of the schools to the same standard. That, to me, has always been the most confusing thing, which is we want to have an outcome-based system, but we want to have different standards of how we determine that outcome for different levels of schools.
Chairman Trujillo, you've heard the criticism that with the action the House took and the Senate took and the governor signed House Bill 7069 last year, it helped further create what Representative Moskowitz referred to as this two-tier system by allowing charter schools to have access to public funds through public school districts, money that had been really earmarked for public school districts' capital projects, computers and buildings and those kinds of things. Do you agree? Has Florida created a two-tier education system?
I think it is somewhat of a two-tier, but I think the ultimate solution is a voucher system.
Voucher system.
Right. Give the money to the parents. Let the parents decide what's in the best interest of their child. The parents know their child's abilities or inabilities better than anybody else. And let the parents be in control of their children's education. And I've never seen what's the true resistance to that. Because if you are delivering a great product, and a lot of public schools are, you should have no concerns. If you're not, obviously there's going to be some repercussions for that.
So if the state is spending about $7,300 per student this year, is that the value of that voucher, theoretically, in your mind?
It would be much more. Because if you put in all the components for construction and maintenance and all the other money that's covered in
non-instructional money,
you're looking at $9,500, $9,700 per student. If you give every single parent in the state a credit card with $9,700 and saying, go find the best school for your child, competition will increase, outcomes will increase, and the children will receive the best education possible. And those parents will be in control of their children's education. So I don't have to try to game the system by saying that I live in South Miami and using my cousin's address to try to get into a certain school or apply at the lottery to hope I get into Coral Reef, into their magnet program. That's no longer an issue.
Arguably, Representative Moskowitz, the critics would say that kind of system would also add to the inequities that already exist within education.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm against going the voucher avenue, as I think every Democrat that has existed in the state of Florida has had that position for...
Well, the legislature has been against it. It hasn't been able to pass it.
Several decades, yeah. Since they last attempted it. In fact, the voters, I believe, rejected that a long time ago. What I would say, though, is that, look, if you try to get into the charter schools that are in my district, you can't. There is a wait list to get into every single solitary charter school that exists. So if you just look at that, obviously parents are happy with an alternative choice, and a lot of them are making that choice. All I'm saying is if we're going to give parents choices to go to a charter school, a private school, a parochial school, a school of hope, or a public school, and we want to grade everybody on outcomes, I just want the playing field to be the same. So how we're going to grade a public school and a charter school and a private school is all going to be the same. If you're getting state money, contingent upon that state money is we should grade your outcome to see if that was a good investment of state taxpayer money. And so we have created a multi-tiered system. It's not even two tiers. It's just a multi-tiered system. Parents do have choice. But ultimately, you know, there is this fundamental question. There are some things that maybe turning a profit aren't good on. If we're starting to go to a more profitability model on education, where a lot more private corporations are coming into the space, we have to figure out fundamentally what the moral and ethical issues with that is. Because when it came to a public school, whether they spent the money well and didn't, and I can tell you, the chairman can give me 100 examples or more, indefinite probably, of where public schools and school boards misspent taxpayer money. But ultimately, they're not trying to run a profit, right? They're not trying to create additional money for their board or additional money for their CEO. It's about education.
So how is that influencing this multi-tiered system? Where is that multi-tiered system that continued to progress with House Bill 7069 and the schools of hope and the charter schools getting access to the capital funds of public schools? What's the next step in your estimation with your appropriations committee in that?
I think the next step is it was a massive bill last year. We have to give it an opportunity to see if it works. Obviously, this is an exact science. Legislating and politics is never an exact science.
So do you see more money for schools of hope in this next fiscal year then?
I think we have to wait for outcomes. Anything. As much as I support charter schools and traditional public schools, you have to wait for outcomes.
So you don't think there's an appetite to put more money into that kind of system?
I think certain members will have an appetite. You're asking me personally, do I think we should just put more
money? You're the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. You have some sway.
I have some sway, but I think all these bills, whenever you have a massive reform, a massive rewrite, whether it's corrections or healthcare or education, you have to give things an opportunity to work or to fail. And constantly tinkering with them as you're implementing the policy is never a good thing.
The Republican chairman of the House Appropriations Committee in Florida, Carlos Trujillo, along with the committee's ranking Democrat, Jared Moskowitz. Our conversation with the two continues. Healthcare spending is next.
You know, I think healthcare is such a difficult environment because there really is no solution.
Every idea that the Democrats have come up with and every idea that the Republicans have come up with have never controlled the cost of healthcare.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. This fiscal year, the state of Florida expects to spend almost $27 billion on Medicaid, providing health care for low-income Floridians. About two-thirds of that comes from the federal government. But the state's Office of Economic and Demographic Research calls Medicaid, quote, the single largest driver of spending over the next 3 years. It's just one piece of the healthcare spending puzzle as state lawmakers gather tomorrow for the beginning of the 2018 legislative session and their efforts to craft a state spending plan. We spoke with Democrat Jared Moskowitz from Broward County, the ranking member on the Florida House Appropriations Committee, and Republican Carlos Trujillo from Dade County, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. We spoke with him about the challenges of health care spending by the state of Florida.
You know, I think healthcare is such a difficult environment because there really is no solution. Anytime you have a third-party payer system, you will have the outcomes we have. And I think that's the hardest part facing healthcare in America, not only in the state of Florida. We have a third-party payer system, so it's just constant cost shifting. You have uninsured, you have people with subsidized insurance, you have people with commercial insurance, and it's this constant balancing act of who's really going to play, who's going to pay the bill. And that's something we have to change in healthcare. And part of it is we have to start breaking down these institutions.
What's the role of the state legislature in that?
The role of the state legislature, just like I'm a big advocate of vouchers, individual health savings account. I think for...
Which do exist in the private market.
Which do exist in the private market and should exist in the Medicaid market. Why can't a mother's going to decide who's the best provider for her child, what's the best network for their child, and give the mother that availability. And if the mother decides not to choose it, she says, you know what, we're just going to do primary checkups. My child's healthy. He's great. He's 4 years old. Save the money. Save that money because maybe one day they might need it. And maybe one day the high deductible plans that are offered through Obamacare are not sufficient for them and they can't meet those deductibles. Give them that opportunity. And from the institutions. Why is there such a push for large, mammoth, emergency room, hospital-type systems when there could be a lot more community-based care? Why is there such a push for controlling the scope of practice across all industries when a lot of people could serve, especially low-income and
profitability is the reason why, vertical integration.
And not even profitability. I don't think hospitals are much more profitable because you limit scope. It's really special interest protecting their turf. The biggest wild card is I show up to the hospital. I have no idea what it costs. Whether I have my commercial insurance, my Medicaid, my Medicare, whatever it is, private pay, I have no idea what it costs.
Now you're talking about price transparency here, right? And the secrecy that exists between both the private insurer and the medical provider in some cases.
And you can't have any competition. Why is the gas industry so competitive? Because you drive down any single street, you drive down Southwest 8th Street, Northwest 12th, you know the price of every single, you know, unleaded, regular, super, premium, every single one is displayed. Why, except for emergency situations, why can't everything else be the same? Why can't I know that if my wife is a regular scheduled pregnancy, we have four children, that the price is going to cost $8,500 or $7,200 or $6,700, and I can make a decision saying, all right, I'm willing to sacrifice on quality, I'm really driven by cost, whatever my you know analysis is and coming to that point.
The state is a big buyer of health services for its own employees. Couldn't the state take a significant step and the legislature take a significant step and provide full price transparency when it comes to your own payer claims?
You know, I wish it was that simple. We've tried multiple years in the House. It's constantly failed in the Senate.
How do you see the insurance and healthcare industry as it exists, not only in Florida, but in the United States, influencing that growing portion of the Florida budget?
It's notice the amount of special interests and advocates for it. If it wasn't an industry and they had no interest, there would be no registered lobbyists and no registered advocates and no associations and nobody advocating on their behalf. But unfortunately, it's such a profitable industry that I would say the majority of registered lobbyists and the majority of interests are related to healthcare.
Representative Moskowitz, let me bring you back in here. Is it special interests that are driving the healthcare cost portion of the Florida state budget?
Well, let me divide the conversation into two segments. First is I totally agree with the chairman on transparency. I consider myself a relatively intelligent person. And we've gone to the hospital plenty of times. We've had two kids. They've gotten hurt. My wife's had to have surgery before. I've had surgery. I never know what it's going to cost. I don't even know for months later what it cost. In fact, I don't even know what I'm going to have to pay. Yes, I know my deductible, but still I get bills from the doctors. Well, I didn't know what portion the insurance company was going to decide to pay. That's not clear anywhere. It is just some mathematical formula that they've worked out with that doctor or with that hospital of what they've decided to reimburse and then what my portion is going to be. So it is one of the weirdest experiences that you have. You go to a hospital, you get what's necessary, and you have no idea what you've just spent at all.
Couldn't the state of Florida, as a big buyer of health services on your behalf and your family's behalf, if you're insured through the state, couldn't the legislature decide to take a stand and refuse to allow the state to sign non-disclosure agreements with healthcare providers and insurance companies and say, no, we're not going to sign NDAs allowing the price of a regular baby delivery to remain secret between the healthcare provider and the insurance company.
I would completely support that, because I think if it wasn't secret, then it would breed more competition, because then you wouldn't have these negotiations happening in secret of what it would be. So in transparency, I voted for it previously. I think that would bring the system forward into the 21st century. As far as healthcare and insurance in general, to be quite honest, I think both parties have failed. Every idea that the Democrats have come up with and every idea that the Republicans have come up with have never controlled the cost of healthcare. Never once. Health insurance has increased every year over year, period. I don't care who was in charge. So that for me is the example of where the special interests are winning.
Where does Medicaid fit into this? That is the significant source of state spending.
I think the best solution is what we've advocated to President Trump, and hopefully there'll be a solution on that issue, is a block grant. Why does Washington, D.C. write the rules and the network adequacy for a state like Florida, not knowing our unique population, rural versus urban, and all the unique needs of a state like Florida? Why not just give us a block grant and allow us to say, these are the rules for our Medicaid game?
Do you feel, Representative Moskowitz, that Washington, and through the Medicaid funding formula, is putting Florida at a disadvantage, a financial disadvantage?
Well, I'm not for a block grant because I don't know that just giving us control of the money is any better. Is Washington failing us? Yes, but this idea that Tallahassee can succeed at this solution, I've not seen any evidence of. But there has to be some level of subsidizing outcomes for people. If you don't have some level of subsidizing of the market, then people that are born with pre-existing conditions are going to be on other government programs. And they're going to be on other government programs because they got sick, they can't get health insurance, and now they have to sell their house or sell their car, or they can't work. So now they're getting food stamps, they're on government assistance. It's all part of the same puzzle.
The ranking Democrat on the Florida House Appropriations Committee, Jared Moskowitz of Broward County, along with the Republican chair, Carlos Trujillo of Dade County. Still to come as we wrap up our conversation, asking voters to protect more of their home's value from the tax rolls.
We create these apocalyptic scenarios that if this doesn't happen and we don't have these taxes, the world's coming to an end. It doesn't.
Cities and counties may have to decide individually if they want to raise additional revenue.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Most of the money the state government uses to do the things it does comes from sales taxes. About 75 cents of every dollar in general revenue for the state comes from sales taxes. It's different, though, for city and county governments. Property taxes bring in most of the money. So even as state lawmakers debate over how to spend your money, they also have allowed voters to decide if they want to exclude more of their home's value from property taxes. This fall, voters will decide if the homestead exemption should be doubled for primary homes. If approved, it would increase from $25,000 to $50,000 the value homeowners can keep off the tax rolls. It could mean less money for local governments that rely on property taxes, like cities, counties, and school districts. We spoke with Democrat Jared Moskowitz from Western Broward County, the ranking member of the Florida House Appropriations Committee, and Republican Carlos Trujillo from Dade County, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. Now, this is what Chairman Trujillo called the prospects of increasing the homestead property tax exemption.
Great news, Tom.
Great news for you, says Chairman Trujillo, chairman of the Florida Appropriations Committee, the Florida House.
Absolutely. The money's best spent in the consumer's pocket.
This at a time when, again, your state economist has said there's a structural imbalance that exists right now between spending and revenues. This, if approved by voters, could continue to eat away at revenues for the state.
You know, one thing,
and
that
that's
I,
a good thing.
One thing that I saw in 2008, 2009, 2010 during the Great Recession, the world didn't stop. The world did not stop. Government got cut back. Our budget went down to $72 billion. I worked in the state government at that time. You know, that was my primary source of income. The world did not come to an end. Why can't we do that again? We create these apocalyptic scenarios that if this doesn't happen and we don't have these taxes, the world's coming to an end. It doesn't. An additional $25,000, especially for a low-income senior who's being pushed out of her Little Havana house that she's had in her family for 50 years, is a ton of money. Should that money be spent in the county commission Do we really think a better use of that $25,000, the taxable value of that $25,000, is better use being sent to the county commission?
Representative Moskowitz, what about this? Local governments and school districts have raised the concern that, listen, you increase that homestead exemption by doubling it to $50,000, it's going to mean potentially less money coming into those local governments, putting more of a weight, more of an emphasis on state support.
This issue is not in a vacuum. I think the speaker's idea of an additional homestead was a good idea. Okay, and that's why it's going to pass. But we didn't just do that. Over the last several years, we gave hundreds of millions of dollars on CST, back to the community and sales tax, which took revenue away from cities and counties.
Right, right.
Okay, and so had we done the homestead just several years ago and not the communication sales tax, it would have had less of an impact. Impact to residents, which is what I'm talking about, tax cuts that matter, but it would have had less of an impact to cities and counties because they wouldn't have gotten this double hit.
This tax cut, the homestead exemption property tax increase, which could decrease property taxes, but the knock-on effect in 2019, in 2020, in local and state governments, as we go through this budgetary process, this cycle every 12 months, either of you may not be part of that process, but what is it that will be inherited?
Well, look, I was on a city commission. And so cities and counties may have to decide individually if they want to raise additional revenue.
The millage rates.
Yeah, if they want to raise their millage rate or if they want to raise fees that they charge, they can make those decisions, okay? Which is why I disagreed with this idea that we have to have super majorities on the commissions to make those decisions, because ultimately, they're accountable to the voters. So if some city decides they want better roads, they want better parks, we need to raise the millage, they can vote that. And if the residents thought that was a terrible idea, they'll vote them out of office.
Chairman Trujillo, do you think, though, that assuming voters approve of an increased homestead property tax exemption, it could lead in the next cycle to higher local tax rates?
No, because a lot of these municipalities already hit their millage, and they have to own that vote. So if you're a local elected official, now you have to make a tough choice. Am I going to really run and campaign raising taxes in a very high tax area, or am I going to try to cut some of the waste that we see in all governments, local, school board, state, everywhere? One thing I've never heard as a politician and as a resident of the state of Florida, anybody ever sent me a mail saying, you know what, we're good on money. Don't send in this tax payment. We're fine. There's plenty of money this year. You take a year off, take a break. What I always hear every single year is the boy who cried wolf. If we don't raise taxes, if we don't spend money, if we don't collect more money, the world will come to an end. And it never does. It never, never, never does. If voters want it, let them have it. And if they decide that local governments should live and state governments should live with less money, that's the voters' will, and it should be followed, and local governments should act accordingly.
Two leaders of the Florida House Appropriations Committee, Republican Chair Carlos Trujillo of Dade County, Democrat Jared Moskowitz, ranking member of Broward County. Pilar Uribe is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.